First of all, welcome to those of you who are not familiar with the University of Glasgow. I'm what technically called the University of Glasgow a professor. And the university has many professors employed at great public expense to ask academic questions. An example of an academic question is this. If George Bush and Tony Blair were to jump off the Squinty Bridge at the same time, who would reach the Clyde first? And the correct answer is, who cares? This is one of many questions we will be asking this evening. First of all, for the benefit of our speakers, I'd like to know something about the audience. If you have an NHS connection, could you put up your hand? Large number. If you have a university connection, up your hand. If you have a local authority connection, not so many. If you have a local government or central government connection. And if you would classify yourself primarily as a member of the public, please put up your hand. So, for our speakers, it's mainly a university, NHS, and partly lay audience. And the other question I'd like to ask is, and this is not a loaded question, how many of you were able to access the web link material before you came? Julian's article and David's response. I guess about half of the audience. So there's a bit of priming, but not comprehensive. Some of you may have wondered what we had in mind by organising this meeting. And the simple idea was this: to bring two forces of nature together in controlled conditions and to observe the effect in the presence of a large number of neutral observers. Not the only way in which that proposition is being tested today, but by far the less expensive and hopefully the more productive. We have as our two main speakers two giants in their fields who have really straddled the history of the UK welfare system and National Health Service. They have been prolific in their writing. They have varied enormously in the practical context in which they have played out their ideas about the welfare state and the NHS. And they are nonetheless passionate now in their 80s, which is why we've invited them here today. Think of it as a Buena Vista social club for social policy and social medicine. Our two speakers are certainly the right side of 80 to qualify for that criteria. Ibrahim Ferrier, the late lead singer of this combo, famously said that the importance of the Cuban Revolution was not only that it protected the Cuban people from having too little, it also protected them from having too much. There is a risk in bringing together two people who are accustomed to being centre stage and who have only met each other once before in my kitchen. So there is a risk. But our two colleagues have been up for it. I don't know whether this is meaningful to Julian, but the subtext of this is that the two people are still game. We're looking for a positive evening. George Burns, in this picture, reached 100 and famously said that if he'd known he was going to live so long, he'd have looked after himself better. We earnestly hope that Julian and David reach their 100. The title comes from Tolstoy. in a book he wrote in 1886 to summarize the malaise of the times, when a very large number of people were oppressed within the new economic and social conditions. We had a discussion this morning as to whether Lenin's pamphlet in 1901 on what then should we do, or what needs to be done, what is to be done, was borrowed from Tolstoy or not. And if there are any Russian scholars in the audience who could tell us whether these two formulations actually come from the same Russian, we would be interested to know. Tolstoy's text is the source of this rather well-known quote. I sit on the man's back, choking him and making him canny, and yet assure myself and others that I'm very sorry for him and wish to ease his lot by all possible means except by getting off his back. Nowadays we would formulate that with, if you're not part of the solution, possibly you're part of the problem. An aspect of this, illustrated vividly in Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs, is the magic mirror. Mirror, mirror on the wall, who's the fairest of us all? A device that allows us to see ourselves as we would like to see ourselves, as opposed to how we really are. I've got two final slides in setting the scene. Scotland don't start until 7:30 this evening, so the disappointment has not yet settled in. Alex Salmond's equivalent of the Queen's speech the other week, in which he said that the provision of primary care by private providers would be outlawed, is a huge development and sets us and a stroke in different waters from the NHS in England. But whilst that's very welcome, it's also a huge challenge. In a post-mortem of the Scottish football team, which went to Argentina in 1978, led by Ali McLeod, thinking it would win the competition, and supported by many Scots who thought it would win the competition, William McIlvenny reflected on what it was about the expedition that had encouraged people to think that way. And on reflection, the only factor that could be identified in retrospect that the Scottish team had, that the other Scottish teams did not, that the other teams did not have, which might have encouraged this belief, was the element of Scottishness. And I think there's a challenge for us that Scottishness is not enough in distinguishing us from what's happening in England. There needs to be a very much more powerful demonstration of how things can be done differently. I think the fact that the flyer attracted so many people illustrates that, to some extent, we have touched a nerve. Perhaps not a nerve that is well expressed. And I think it will become clear as the evening goes on what we're talking about. But just to illustrate it, here's a quote from Robert Bolt's A Man for All Seasons, which many of you will know. It's an exchange between Roper and Sir Thomas More. Roper says to Sir Thomas More, "So now you give the devil benefit of law." More replies, "Yes, what would you do? Cut a great road through the law to get after the devil." "I'd cut down every law in England to do that." "Oh, and when the last law was down and the devil turned round on you, where would you hide?" Roper, "The laws all being flat. This country's planted thick with laws. Man's laws, not God's. And if you cut them down and you're just the man to do it, you really think you could stand upright in the winds that would blow then?" "Yes, I'd give the devil benefit of law for my own safety's sake." And the point of the quotation, I think, is that a lot of trees have been felled in terms of the solidarity and social support and protections that individuals have as globalization runs its way. And I think we will be returning this evening to the ways in which individuals can act and can protect themselves individually and collectively in this new climate, not just economic but meteorological. Ladies and gentlemen, will you please welcome with me to the front of the stage our two guests, Julian Tudor Hart and David Donison. To you how this meeting is going to run. It's been called a conversation with David Donison and Julian Tudor Hart for the very reason that that's what it is. There is going to be no didactic lectures. There is going to be no extensive question and answer of the speakers. There is going to be a conversation to which you are all welcome to take part. And we'll see how it goes. In a minute, I'll ask Julian and David to give opening statements, which reflect to some extent the two papers previously circulated, because we have to start somewhere. Julian is the protagonist, and David is responding, which is a bit unfair on David, but he'll have the last word at the end of the evening. And there'll be the opportunity for question and answer to clarify what they've said, and there'll be a dialogue between the two of them to begin with, and then we'll open the discussion out to the floor. And I'll be taking questions and comments, and be particularly welcoming comments, and collecting them in threes and fours, and then it'll be up to Dave and Julian whether to reply. And we'll just see where we get. But let me return, first of all, to the one occasion in which they had met prior to today, in my kitchen, and it hinged on what they were doing one evening in 1945. Can you tell us, David, what you were doing that evening and where you were and why it was such a significant occasion?
I think Graham's talking about the moment when the results of the 1945 election came through. I was a midshipman on the bridge of a cruiser steaming through the Indian Ocean in a hot, black, tropical night, and the news came through, totally unexpected by everybody, of the Labour landslide. And there was a kind of frisson through the coming hours on the lower decks, and a good deal of anxiety in the wardroom. It was an unforgettable moment.
Yes. And Julian, where were you then?
I was preparing for my sort of A-levels in Canada. No, O-levels, I suppose, really. And about to get on a boat to come back to England. But I was very excited about the election, and I thought this was the new world.
Was that excitement similar in any way to the feelings after the next Labour landslide in 1997?
I don't think it was. There are different opinions about this, but I think there were huge expectations in 1997, but I don't think there was the colossal, unstoppable movement that got going in 1944 in the forces, mainly, which really gave the Attlee government no alternative but to move forwards perhaps further and faster than it would have liked to do. We didn't have that. I don't think we had that kind of groundswell that had 10, 12 years to build up. Yeah. I think we might be getting it now.
I think it's important to bear in mind that for young servicemen in 1945, I was 19, we were not greatly concerned, to be honest, about health care or about social security from the cradle to the grave or subsidised housing or secondary education for all the things that the welfare state later made possible. We had the kind of arrogance of young men who believe they're immortal, and were concerned about, was this going to create an equal society? To bring the class war to an end? Was it going to transform relationships within the Britain we would be going back to shortly? It was in many ways a pre-revolutionary situation.
Which took an enormous disruption and upheaval to generate.
Yeah.
Julian, I'm going to ask you to say your piece.
Yeah. Well, I'll come up there, because I've got a few notes to prepare myself to keep within 8 minutes and not be didactic. I don't know how not to be didactic. What Graham was just talking about now, this earthquake business, I don't think you get real political change. Certainly you don't get progressive political change without an earthquake. There has to be an enormous cultural and political and societal shift going on. And it's between 1929 with the American crash and 1945 when the consequences of that crash were finally more or less resolved, at least for a few generations. That was an earthquake. It was a world earthquake. Swept away practically all monarchies, all the monarchies that since then, with the possible exception of Spain, are just decorations. Swept away empires. They took a few years for that to be obvious, but it soon happened. And now I think 2008 is probably the first year of a similar earthquake, but bigger and more threatening. To have an earthquake, you've got to have a fault developing somewhere, a break. And where is the break? Where's the fault? Where's the weakness in the system? I think it's where Marx said it was. I think it's that modern production, industrial production, is social. People have to do it cooperatively in large units. But distribution and the distribution of investment, the direction of effort, serves private interests rather than public interests. So I think that's the fundamental problem. But the way it's expressed is that we have two worlds. That's what I was trying to get at in the Lancet article. We have the world of business and business ethics, and we have the entire, what Adam Smith called the non-productive sector. And it's interesting that Karl Marx called it that as well, because they were both talking about the commodity production. That the whole economy was described as a commodity economy. But the non-productive sector, the most important thing in it has never been health services or social services or prisons or police or anything like that. It's been domestic service. It's been child rearing and husband feeding and generally looking after the family, which is always supposed to be the absolute foundation of society. So this most precious and valuable of all, necessary of all services, that's non-productive. That's an extraordinary idea. And what's been happening over the last 10 years is that as capitalism has engulfed really everything, every aspect of what we do, the whole of our culture, and globally, it also devours this second world, the non-productive sector that was previously outside the commodity economy. It's eating it up. And of course, the successive Thatcher governments that we've had, Mark 1, Mark 2, and now Mark 3 for the last, well, I suppose it's Mark 4, isn't it, technically, and Brown take over from Blair, that it's being handed as far as they can, all this non-productive sector is being handed over to business, even including child rearing, with the obvious inevitable consequences that children are not being reared. They are just getting bigger and bigger and tougher, and once they can wield knives and guns, they do so. And unless they go in the army, then they break the law. What is to be done about all this? I love the title. It's even shorter in Russian. I haven't looked at what it was for Tolstoy, but for Lenin it was "Что делать?" Very short. What to do? And I suspect that Tolstoy's was the same. I think we made it a little bit more complicated in translation, but I may be wrong about that. Lenin's answer, I think, has turned out to be completely wrong, and led to a huge diversion from a useful path of social progress, but in which an enormous amount was learned, or should have been learned. So what's our version got to be? I think the first stage of it is that we separate these two worlds, that we resume the independent development of the service, public service sector, and the, well, the whole non-productive sector of social service, which I think includes work in the home. We've got to separate them so that we can resume a development of World 2 as autonomous as it's possible to do. There are limits to that, but we certainly could get back at the very least to the defences that were surrounded universities, schools, social services to some extent, certainly medicine, until this new development of the business world eating up the service world. I think the second thing we've got to do is to democratise our world of public service. It never was democratic, and by democratic we mean participated democracy, that you measure democracy, that you measure the real extent of democracy by the extent to which decisions are taken by people to whom those decisions will apply. That people are not taking decisions about other people who don't suffer the consequences of those decisions. I think we have an enormous task ahead of us in doing that. So part one is to get renew independence, which I think the decisions of both the Welsh and the Scottish regional governments are doing. And the second is to make use of that separation to begin the process of democratisation within the public sector. And the second huge task, which is much easier to see for doctors than for any other kind of social worker, doctors and social workers, is to use our professional autonomy, the traditions of professional autonomy, to act democratically ourselves, to work in a democratic style that recognises that patients and clients, if you want to call them that, or anyway in general the public subjects of all this work, that they participate as co-producers of a social value rather than as consumers acquiring a private gain. I think it's very important for us doctors to recognise the enormously greater autonomy that we have, even now, than any other kind of social worker. It's very, very hard for most social workers to establish that autonomy. But I think they can do that, because and the way you do it, of course, just as with the doctors, is ultimately to appeal to your patients, your clients, your public, your community, for them to back you up, which they will do. I think that's it.
Thank you, sir.
The thing that strikes me in what you say, encouraging individuals to make a difference, I think there's a sense of powerlessness against huge forces. Even governments are powerless in relation to multinationals and whatever. And that seems to be associated almost with a defeatism, do you think?
Well, if you interpret it that way, I mean, I industrial workers who have not disappeared yet, they are diminishing, so that enormously weakens them rather than growing. But they're still there. They learned long ago, two centuries ago, they began the process of learning, that the way you give yourself strength is unity. You've got to have solidarity. And that's what all these 1945 social services were about. It was about social solidarity. But I, as I said, I think we need to be cautious. It's easy for doctors, especially for GPs, to throw their weight about and become local public figures. I've always taken advantage of that, the ease with which we could do that. But it's much more difficult for other people. But then it was damn difficult for unorganized coal miners and steel workers and shipbuilders and so on. They had one hell of a time to establish the right to organize and to act. In fact, they've lost a good deal of what they originally gained now. So, I mean, in the end, there has to be a political shift, doesn't there?
David, over to you.
Shall I respond to everything that's been said? Is it okay if I sit here and just talk? I said that in 1945 we were hoping for a transformed society, not just a lot of useful public services, important though they were, which came to be. How far we would get in that direction was going to depend heavily on the public service professions, who, in a way we hadn't, I think, fully foreseen, took over after the Second World War local leadership in many fields from the gentry, who for hundreds of years had dominated local communities. There are many examples that one could offer, just asserted. And the way in which they and the public services they ran operated would go a long way to shape how far we progressed towards this hope for a more equal society in which people treated each other with respect valued all their fellow citizens. I think for a while we actually made a lot of progress in that direction. It was as unemployment began to grow in the 70s and there emerged a whole area of society excluded from work that it became increasingly clear that while the welfare state had achieved all sorts of very important things, many of the class conflicts which used to rage between employers and their workers, between landlords and their tenants, had shifted to the counters, the classrooms, the consulting rooms of the welfare state. Some of these were quite explicit. I quoted in the note that some of you have read the old joke from the Glasgow housing schemes, what would you call 1,000 dead housing officers? Answer, a start. Now, you know, that's a pretty explicit recognition of the class war across the counters of the welfare state, and there are many others. The same people who coined that joke called the social security officers, on whom so many depended to keep body and soul together, the SS. And social security officers, with whom I worked closely for 5 years, if asked in the pub by strangers, so what do you do, would say, well, I'm a civil servant. Now, the more important than these explicit conflicts were the more deeply rooted implicit conflicts, which in the health service are represented by the inverse care law. Since so many of you come from the NHS world, you will know very well what I'm talking about. But for the rest, this is the law which tells us that the sicker a population is, the poorer they will be, and the less the quantity and the poorer the quality of medical care that they will receive. There are all sorts of reasons for that. It's not just the fault of doctors. Yeah?
Am I right in thinking that the correct way to end that is to say, and this is due to market forces?
Yeah.
No, it is not due only to market forces. It happens also in the state system, I would assert, and we can argue about that some more, I hope, in a moment. Education has the same patterns. They don't call it the inverse care law, but this country, the UK, has, for the top 10% of its achievers in the education system, some of the best attainments you can find anywhere in the world. For the bottom 25-30%, it has some of the very worst in the developed world. That gap is not only due to teachers, but it is, they play an important part. They and the administrators in our educational system play an important part in that divisive and humiliating and destructive pattern of education. And it's not surprising if you look at the class sizes, if you look at the expenditure on libraries, if you look at the costs per pupil of the various systems that different social groups go through, it is not surprising that we have those differences. The people at the top end get much more and much better service. Let me give you one more example. Since it's Scotland, we should recall the Millen Report, which led to the Mental Health Act of 2003 and a Scottish first, an innovation not to be seen anywhere else in the world, I think. But that report about the mental health services of this country, meaning Scotland, and the Act which followed very directly from it, is full, you know, paragraph by paragraph and clause by clause in the Act, of provisions to protect people from financial exploitation, from sexual abuse, from covert medication, medicine put in your food without anybody telling you or warning you about the side effects, from the imposition without the patient's consent of treatments, ECT and the like, that were damaging and painful, from uncontrolled violence to control patients, from prolonged incarceration in hospitals that people should have been freed from. Now, these steps in the Act, following from that report, were not the whim of some starry-eyed reformer. They arose from the fact that this was the first committee of its kind that included among its members people who had long experience in mental hospitals as patients. It was the first committee of this kind that had taken so much trouble to go all around the country and repeatedly listen to current and former patients of the health services and their carers, their families, their supporters, looking after them when they were at home in the community. And the things they were talking about were, and some of them still are, going on. It's not some Dickensian piece of ancient terrible history. These are the kinds of things that show how often the most vulnerable people have not been fairly treated, not been given the resources they need, have not been given justice, and how the welfare state, while it has solved many problems and made a better world in all sorts of ways, has also retained a lot of the class conflicts and the exploitation and the injustices of former times, but in new forms. I think there are malign, greedy, profit-oriented marketeers who are, you know, the people who've brought PFIs and the contracting out of services and the marketization and monetization of the welfare state into the system. We all recognize that. And Julian and Alison Pollock, whose book I've profited from, have vividly laid out that story. I don't think there's going to be much of a contest against that in a Scottish audience of this kind. But there are also marketeers, let's call them that, who introduced some of these things because they were conscious of how badly the system was treating some of our most vulnerable fellow citizens. There's a radical, progressive version of the challenge to the public service professions that needs to be listened to. And if they got a lot of the wrong answers in addressing those problems, we have got to give them better answers. Because if we can't give them better answers, we'll be back with the market in some form or other. And I hope we can spend much of the rest of this evening talking about the better answers we need to put together. When Thatcher introduced the disempowerment of the public service professions and its power basis, local government, universities, royal commissions in the early 80s, and imposed cuts on so many of the services that they ran, we all turned out and protested and marched under the banners of our unions and our professional institutions. And it was a proper thing to do. But the patients, the social work clients, the pupils and their families from the schools, the council tenants, they were not marching at our side. And the government spotted that and pressed on with its cuts. And we shall be back in the same dilemmas. We've already got cuts in the real pay of many public sector workers beginning, and we may have more serious developments shortly. We shall be back in all that if we do not have those who depend most heavily upon our services marching at our side next time. What can we do? I want to suggest quickly half a dozen things that occurs to me we may want to talk about, ideas we may want to develop. There are only half a dozen. There are half a dozen at least more that you will want to bring into the discussion. First, there's the Human Rights Act. It's a cumbrous, slow-moving piece of legislation brought in from Europe. But nevertheless, a brave prisoner, supported by a few brave governors and prison officers, brought slopping out to an end in every British jail by using the Human Rights Act. I think we can all think of some users of our public services who may have a case under the Human Rights Act, and that sort of, those kind of powers could be used again to some effect. There is the growth of direct payments. Local authorities are under increasing pressure to provide for people receiving care in the community, not the care that the authority decides and provides, but the money the local authority is prepared to make available for them to decide what care they need, who will provide it, what hours they will call, and all the other things that they would prefer to decide for themselves. I think that is a development that's going to go much further. It works pretty well often where we're dealing with physically disabled people well supported by loving and competent families. It presents all sorts of rather different problems when the users of direct payments are people with mental disorders on their own without family support, whose needs may be so complicated that the social workers have said, for God's sake, give them the money and let them decide, it's too difficult for us. Now, thirdly, there are various forms of governance of public services that involve user control in various forms and to varying degrees. Bring the users of the services onto your committees, bring them into the panels that interview candidates for jobs and help select the people you appoint. There are some rather good examples in the world of the community-based housing associations in this country of handing over a lot of the power to the tenants in that case. We need to think about other ways of developing that idea in many other services. There's, just to take one profession, planning aid. An example that other professions should, I believe, be thinking about. The town planners long ago set up their own charity, staffed by volunteers of highly qualified planners, who in their evenings and weekends can help the public cope with the system they administer during their working day. Should teachers, should social workers, should police, and maybe doctors, be thinking of doing something of the same kind? There's advocacy, since again we're in Scotland, that followed from that Mental Health Act 2003. We have provided here, many of you will know, a right under the law to free and independent advocacy for people with mental disorders, learning difficulties or mental illness, whether they're in hospital or out in the community, whether they're subject to compulsion or not as voluntary patients. That's a major step. we should bear in mind that Hector Mackenzie, some of you may know, in the Scottish Health Department, retired a few weeks ago, who was a civil servant, played a leading part in getting that into the Act, tried earlier to persuade senior colleagues in other departments, in what was then the Scottish Executive, it was before the Parliament began, all to chip in and to a shared budget which would give users of every public service in Scotland a right to independent advocacy. His colleagues declined, not surprisingly perhaps, but his challenge remains with us, because the better and more effective advocacy agencies are already extending their services to people with other needs besides those of mental disorder, dealing with quite other services, and indeed with the private sector, with banks, with landlords, with employers. You can't draw a boundary line of clientele and say we're only going to advocate for these people. And I can explain why if you want to ask. Other people here who know.
Can we leave the fifth and sixth until later on?
The last one.
Yeah.
If I may just do that, and I'll promise to stop. We could ask the users of the services how they feel about the service they get. I'm at an age when more and more of my relatives and my friends end up in hospital. They break a hip or a knee or have a stroke or whatever. They get, on the whole, very good service from the professionals when they get them. But they end up in a ward. And, you know, if they can't get out of bed, does anybody bring a bedpan when they need one and ask for one? Does anyone, when they drop their spectacles on the floor, help them pick them up? If the person who eventually comes to do that finds the floor under the bed has not been swept for a fortnight, do they get a broom? I could run on. If they can't eat the food that is placed before them because it's so horrible or because their diet precludes it, does anyone ask what's wrong? Or is it just whisked away after an hour by somebody who never speaks to them, a full plate guy, and they're left bloody starving? Now, we don't need 8 years training in medical schools and teaching hospitals to get those things right. You know, your granny and my granny could teach us how to treat fellow human beings with courtesy, with kindness, with respect, how to take responsibility for the strangers who might come to our home or to our place of work. We could ask people about their experience. If you take a car for a repair to Glasgow's biggest car repairer, you, God help us, 3 days later have to answer a few questions, somebody phones you up, and 20 minutes later you've been told everything you could possibly imagine about your car and what happened to it and the service you got in the workshop and in the showroom and everywhere else, and would you recommend a friend to come back here and buy another car or repair their car? Nobody asks you from the Western Infirmary what do you think about your treatment. Do they listen to you? If they did ask, would they do anything about it?
One of the things that we don't lack are policies to do that. Documents and paper. You know,
you're the expert. I don't know.
There was an issue in The Guardian a couple of weeks ago where someone was saying that the more the current government had talked about democratising services and taking account of public views, the less provision it had made for views to be taken into account. I mean, so there seemed to be a disjoint between what people were saying and what people were actually doing.
Yes.
Yeah. I can't imagine these comments haven't stimulated thoughts in the audience, and the floor is open to anyone who wants to ask questions or make a comment. There are roving mics. Sir?
It's not very well-meaning good points and observations about people, whether in hospital and their experiences. But I think we need to look and ask ourselves why are these things happening? Why do people perhaps ignore somebody's bed because they're falling on the floor? I think you've got to take a step further back and look at the reasons as to why that's occurring, and staff pressures and all the other economical and government pressures that are imposed upon staff in hospitals. And I think you've got to look, I mean, that is observations that you're making and commenting on, but I think to look at the whole picture as to why they're happening.
Just the usual trade union response. However, I won't answer questions.
I want to take several comments before bringing it back to the floor here. There was another one over there. At the back.
I just wanted to mention the word neoliberalism.
Could you say who you are and where you're from, please, because it'll help us.
My name's Mark Langdon, and I'm here as a member of the public, but I'm fortunate enough to be a community development worker in Glasgow. The effect that neoliberalism's had over the last, 2013... It's not like... The mic are playing my head, or they've got me booked. Basically, the effect that had is to shift the political agenda so that now, especially in some of the UK and the States, we are no longer questioning the validity of many of the underlying principles that have been applied across the education, across local government. And there's an article in, yes, it's in the Pain Report, it might be in the Herald, I think it was Edward Lee, as a commission that the UK government had just pointed out that only a fifth of the departments within the government actually costed out the effect of their policies when they were making them. And for me, that speaks of a cultural incompetence. And I think in society, we point the finger constantly at the poorest and most vulnerable, and we seem to be saying it's their fault that, they are falling out of society. We have we have a top-down culture in this society. The fault lies at the top. And I would say a lot of the fault lies in the lack of values, the loss of direction within our political system. I'm sorry, I've got promised he was a real nice guy, and I'm sure he's not helped me at all. But if you look at in a place like Scotland where we're discussing our health, we look at why that has refused to improve in line with other similar type of countries. You'd have to say, as a community development worker, we've got a history of undermining community involvement and community power again and again and again across decades. And I think if we are not willing to say that the emperor's got no clothes, if we are not able to stand up and say that we need a political system, politicians, and the heads of our agencies to act with a sense of values, with to enact the policies and the strategies and the ethos behind those, to show leadership, statespersonship, whatever. So that's why we are, and that's what the willing state we're in. And what we need to do about it is hold ourselves and the people that represent us to account. And until we do that, we will talk and talk and talk and go precisely nowhere.
Alison.
I'd like to come back to this theme of democratisation, and in particular involving people, because maybe, I don't know how many people are aware that one of your mechanisms, the consulting users of services, has actually been privatised, both in England and in Scotland. So in Scotland, the Scottish Government has privatised patient involvement and users of services, and has contracted out those functions to PricewaterhouseCoopers under quite large contracts. And the same thing is actually happening in England. So primary care trusts and health services are now privatising those functions out to the Picker Institute and around 8 to 10 companies, including United Healthcare and others. So we're seeing a very subtle shift. We're seeing the marketisation and privatisation of user surveys, and many people actually don't realise that and don't know that when they're seeing results reported in newspapers. So that's one thing to alert you to. And indeed, a group of academics, some 20, including Graham, wrote to the minister protesting against privatisation of user surveys and user views, both from a public health perspective, but also the degradation of research. But the academic community has largely been silent on this issue, and so have patients and the public and the health service. So that's maybe one example. The second is that Scotland isn't strong on mechanisms for democratisation, and such mechanisms as there were, for example, in health, have largely and increasingly been ripped out. And again, I'd like to draw your attention, I'm going to use a case study because sometimes it's a good way of explaining things to people. But 2 years ago, an elderly retired lawyer came to me who lives in Kinlochranach because he was really concerned because the antivirus service was about to be withdrawn and that the GPs no longer wanted to provide an antivirus service. Now, everybody knows that's a very remote and rural area in Scotland. And initially, the health board were on the public and community side, but in fact, the local GP insisted and triggered a panel, which then meant that the local community had no right of consultation in the secondary legislation. So the community were completely hamstrung, and the GP got his way. The panel ruled that they didn't actually have any entitlement to GP services. And if you think it's more than an hour's travel, sometimes an hour and a half's travel, to the local medical facility. This is very, very serious for this local community. So over the last 2 years, they've been arguing, and the GP has now retired and was given assurances by the minister, that when the GP was being advertised again, that out-of-hour services would be included. But in fact, they found that this did not happen. And so this elderly, quite frail population, but also with quite a lot of young children there, have no access to a local GP. Now, some 2 weeks ago, Tayside Health Board turned up in the local community with 29 representatives on a Saturday and told the public that their preferred solution was a company called First Response. This company says it's a charity, but it's a company. And actually, if you look, First Responder is actually another US origin. And their solution to providing antivirus care for their local community is actually to train up, to ask the local community to raise £15,000 and to train up 5 volunteers. So in Kinlochranach, that would be forestry attendants, petrol pump attendant. And they will get 5 days training, and that will become the substitute GP medical service. Now, this is a model that has been rolled out and proposed in lots of parts of Scotland. In some places, it's been sold as an add-on, additional to your GP out-of-hours service. So what we've seen with the UK GP contract is two processes going on. A, the marketisation and commercialisation, which is happening in a big way south of the border with Virgin and other brands, Richard Branson now moving in to take over GP services. But also a real degradation of the professional role, so that GPs, having opted out of our services, now are actually seen between 6 at night and 8 in the morning. Actually, patients in vulnerable and remote communities may not have any access at all to medical care. And so I don't know how much many of you are aware of what's going on, but one of the things, if we're going to really look at democratisation, is that we need to become much more alert, much more critical, much more thinking, and organised much more in terms of our local communities. The most heartbreaking thing about Kinlochranach is the way in which the health board is dividing and ruling, dividing that local population, and indeed the way in which the GPs are not rising to defend their local population. So I've given you these two examples, and Scotland has no cause to be complacent. We have very weak democratic structures, even weaker than in England. And unless we start to open up the debate and begin to get the information, we are not going to be able to engage in any critical way at all or come up with any solutions.
Thank you. But it's just possible that there are people in the audience who don't know that Alison is Alison Pollock. And there are GPs in the audience. Does anyone want to respond to that?
Alison's book.
Colin?
Not quite respond to it, but if I could give another example of how our system is undemocratic. Some years ago, with your help, Graham, and various others, I tried to have a an area of land that had been used for many years for children to play on in party. Be kept solely for children. Thornwood Park, in the end, were partly successful. But it's terrible the way that we have planning laws in this country, and I think in England too, whereby a developer can look at a piece of land, you know, a piece of land that children, as Julian was saying, children need somewhere to go out to play, to get healthy, you know, and not be fat. But developers can look at that land, and they can put forward proposals to use that land for, you know, luxury flats. And their proposals, when they're put forward, if they're not back, they just put another proposal in. And they keep putting in these proposals, and they did that in Thornwood. They kept changing it, and eventually they were granted permission to build the flats. Then the surprise comes. The local community do not have any right to say, hang on, we'd like to appeal against this. So it's not just GPs that are the bad boys here. You know, the planning legislation, I think, needs to be changed as well.
Do either of you want to come in at this point?
Well, yeah, I'm a bit... you see, I think David made a very good case for the private provision of care. If you... Well, you did. I mean, you know,
nonsense.
I don't mean
nonsense.
I didn't mean. I didn't say that you intended to make it, but you did make it. I mean, the guy who, or the lady who dropped her spectacles on the floor and nobody bothered to pick them up, wouldn't have happened in this garage that you're talking about that maintains cars instead of people. I mean, it is, of course. The facts are exactly as you've stated them, but I remember starting in South Wales my first encounter with working as a GP to a then industrial, now post-industrial area, coal mining villages in Rhondda, as a locum. I'd see 60 patients in the morning and another 60 patients in the evening, and I had 25 house calls in between. And I selected perhaps four or five people during a day's work on whom I did something more or less approaching what I'd been taught in my medical school. Even that was far from adequate by present day standards. To actually do something about their reversible conditions. All the others, I simply met expectations, which in a community of that kind will be very, very low. They're all about just signing things and prescribing things and so on. I practiced very, very bad medicine, and I knew I was practicing very, very bad medicine. And one of my many anxieties was, can I go on doing this for the full fortnight that I'm paid for? Without being permanently damaged? The answer to that question is no, you can't. You will be permanently damaged, and I was permanently damaged. And all my life I've worked in poor communities, and any space that you create to do your work properly, you create yourself very largely at your own expense. And that's only because the GPs had enough autonomy that they could set their terms of work. But you know, you can just simply accept half the pay that other people get. But that isn't any solution. And I agree with our friend up there that said you have to ask why somebody can get to the point where they don't even notice that somebody has dropped their spectacles in the floor that hasn't been cleaned for a fortnight and so on, which you didn't. You, the passerby, did not clean for a fortnight. There are reasons why people get burnt out and clapped out and give up and just feel that the best they can do is to survive in the system. That is the channel through which Thatcher drove in privatisation of care. And the word, you know, the important word is, I haven't heard anybody use it. It's consumerism that does this. It's giving people the idea that their status and value is as consumers, not as producers. But people used to, working class people used to derive their dignity, their own sense of dignity, from what they did. They knew that they were actually much more important people and much more important to society than the people that they had doffed their caps to. And that is what we're in danger of losing. And that's the culture that we have to rebuild around a new kind of economy, but a gift economy. Another word that we haven't used yet.
As ever, I agree with June, except that he, when he tells me I'm advocating
I didn't
privatisation.
But no, I didn't say you that. I didn't say that.
Okay. I wasn't being serious. You're right about the importance of community. You've demonstrated in your own work that we don't have to accept the inverse cow law. That you can get to all the patients in your practice and find out that only half of those with particular life-threatening conditions have even been diagnosed by bringing them all in. But you did that, as I read it, by working with the community, with
and
all the
cheating.
Patients, with the local government, with the NUM and the workers in
and
that area.
And by cheating. I had Graham to help me. Why? Because the MRC paid his salary. Why? Because I published enough papers to make myself respectable
okay, but
in the journal.
But I'm saying
but I got more labour in. I did get more people.
But the innovators do seize opportunities and create them in that kind of way. We don't have to accept the inverse cow law or its equivalents in other services as part of nature.
The trouble
but
is
we
that we
tackle it through working for the whole community, not just as individuals.
Nobody accepts it intellectually. But nevertheless, they tolerate it practically, partly because it doesn't create noise, because the consequence, I shouldn't be saying this, I'm supposed to be chairing this, but I think I have something to add here, which is that the elephant in the room, if it's not a hackneyed thing, is unmet need, which is things that you are ever present in the consultation because you feel you know what you could do. And the reason why there's unmet need is because there's not enough time.
That's right.
And the reason there's not enough time is because ever since World War II, staff in primary care have been rationed like bread and butter and eggs in World War II. Everybody gets access to the same, which means that in poor areas people don't have the resource to respond to need with activity and then get counted into the resource distribution formula. Mm-hmm. There's an interesting twist developing just now. There are people looking at the increased burden of morbidity associated with old age. And saying that is more important and not counted in relation to the morbidity that's present in deprived areas. Now I see a competition developing between the need for more resource in the health service for elderly people who have got longevity and the needs of deprived areas who haven't yet got longevity. And to me that's not something that can be solved by civil servants or professionals. It's a political question that needs to be debated out loud. And we don't have that debate because the debate is not opened up to the public. It is being looked after on our behalf by professionals and civil servants. That would be my take. Would be actually the political discourse that used to take place in the streets has gone into committee rooms.
Could I just make two points? I focused rather on health service examples because 70% of you roughly put your hands up when Graham asked how many of you are involved in the health service. But one could have said exactly the same kinds of things about public housing, about social work, about our schools and many other public services. I'm not getting at the doctors or the nurses. Also, I'm saying, and very important, that the bad examples are only here and there, not far off. But my purely anecdotal evidence from friends and relatives suggests that the local district general hospital is usually very good. And partly I think that's because people may be treating their neighbours or people known to their neighbours and their families. It's they're part of the community. And that's something we somehow need to rebuild in big cities.
Scott Robertson, I manage an independent advocacy service in West of Berkshire on Argyll and Bute. It's a whistle. I think, like most people here, almost in principle, I think that there are certain elements of public service, including health and so on, which shouldn't be driven by a profit motive. But I wonder if each of the speakers and anyone else would want to comment on what they see as the role of the kind of third sector, the voluntary sector, not-for-profit organisations, and their role. David mentioned in his contribution about the growth recently in direct payments and anticipated that would be something that would continue to grow. As part of the service that I work with, we have a project which works specifically with users of community care services who want to use a direct payment as opposed to a service provided directly by the local authority. Most of those people who have direct payments choose to engage with services provided by the voluntary sector. I think the advantage that we see in that is that the services tend to be more person-centred and more flexible. Things like, you know, someone who needs support to go to bed at night can use a direct payment to choose to have that support at 10 o'clock rather than rely on a council service which may only be available at 6:30. So it brings with a kind of flexibility in that sense. I think one of the advantages that the voluntary sector has is a simple one in some senses, and it's one of size. I honestly can't envisage how you begin to democratise the health service in an effective kind of way. And I think that there's I understand no talk of legislation being introduced in the Scottish Parliament for directly elected health boards. I don't think it makes an awful lot of difference in terms of people really feeling involved and engaged on a day-to-day basis. And one final thing I'm interested in, just from discussion, is the different paths that appear to be being taken to some extent in Scotland and Wales as opposed to in England. And it strikes me that, as someone who's never felt particularly British, I think of two institutions which if I had any kind of thing, would be the BBC and the National Health Service. And I just wonder what the implications, the wider implications of this, of those institutions, the National Health Service, have been talking about. There's some, a lot of discussion in the papers about the possibility of Scottish broadcasting, whatever. How do you see that kind of panning out in the years ahead?
Thank you. There was a comment at the back to come in.
My current concerns may seem trivial in the light of the very serious issues that have been raised, but it is centred around the question of human dignity. And people living in deprived communities are exposed day after day to attacks on their personal dignity. And I would like to tell you about my GP who founded the surgery that I attend. Unfortunately, he's now retired, but the practices have continued. When you go to the surgery, the doctor comes to the door of the waiting room, says your name in a gentle kind of way, you stand up, you go to the doctor, and he shakes your hand and says, "Do come in." And you are treated as a human being from the minute you go over that door, and that's extremely important. I go to a clinic in this hospital, and if I go in and say good morning, they look surprised. The nurse who is looking after me looks surprised because I'm taking time away. What she wants to see is my thumb from which she can extract some drops of blood. And I am merely an adjunct of the thumb. And the other area where we deeply are offended is in local authority services. And I think that what we need to emphasise in all our professions, but not only in our professions, in every job of work, is social skills. The ability to say good morning, the ability to look somebody in the eyes when you're speaking to them. And I think that although this may seem a very small thing, I think it really has a fundamental importance if you're going to talk about democracy.
Pat Roach, Edinburgh, Queen Margaret University.
And I'm just trying to draw together a few things here, some major phrases that have come up that have been important this evening, as well as Kay's last comment. And I'm looking at the issues of privatisation, marketing, the degradation of the public role in the patient-practitioner liaison, if you like, the lack of GPs defending this degradation. I'm also looking at the huge rise in technology in medicine in particular, which has taken the public purse, you know, the more fancy apparatus we get for medical diagnosis, the less there is for other things. And basically, as Kay says, the loss of self-respect and of the individual in this liaison. Now, I'm trying not to beat personal drum here, but I'm working in the field of chronic pain, which of course is becoming more and more important. And again and again, I still feel that if what has to be done. I, for a long time, have worked with the increasing science, if you like, which shows, I think, that what has to be done is for medical professionals and associated professionals to avoid what Kay says. You know, the biology of the thumb is not where we're at. The whole individual, if you like, the biological psychosocial model, is what we must promote in general practice and all its associated professions, to a degree where we're actually probably asking even the GPs and the consultants to stop being afraid of finding out from a patient what is it that bothers the patient the most. You know, I mean, a patient comes in with a problem, the medical model tends to look at what is the biology of that problem and try and fix it by cutting it or putting pills into it or doing whatever. Whereas what the patient's problem might be something else entirely. If it's chronic pain, it may be lack of being able to be attractive to a member of the opposite sex. You know, when will medical professionals and their associated professionals be less afraid of even just touching on those aspects, which I think will bring the person back into this interaction? Now, I do not believe that the public expect all of their health professionals, medical professionals, to be the psychologist, to be the social worker, to be the whole bit, hand-holder. But medical professionals, I believe, need to simply indicate to patients a little bit more that they are aware that what bothers the patient the most might be something other than the biology of the symptoms. And that way, I think, is one window back into the patient understanding that they are a person in this interaction, and that their feelings of what bothers the patient the most is perhaps what they come for help with. Now, okay, if...
Can I thank you for that. I want to pass on to others, because we're going to run out of time quite soon. Phil?
I would like to pursue what Julian alluded to, that we are on the cusp of a lot of these sort of seismic shifts. In the light of what we've been talking about, which is that we run into trouble when we turn what should be based on human relationship into something that's based on abstraction, like the market or consumerism or materialism or economism. And it seems to me that that's got us pretty much to the past that we've described. But I don't share David's confidence that another set of abstractions like the human rights law or the like will in themselves, and I'm not sure you are saying the word in themselves. So the question is, how do we restore relationality? And I don't see that we can while we buy into the myth that continued economic growth, continued market forces will provide the solutions to what we have. And as a Marxist, I guess I would ask you a comment on this whole idea that the system will collapse through its own contradictions. And is that not what climate change and peak oil and these other looming disasters are telling us? And is the urgent task, you ask what should we do, it seems to me we need to design a relational economy for a post-oil age that does have far less resources flowing through it, through these mechanisms, and we need to do this urgently.
We're just, I'll come to you in a second. We've advertised that we'll stop at 7, and I don't want it to go on very much longer after 7 unless I feel we're on the verge of discovering something extremely important. Because some of you will have come thinking that you can get away at 7. So I'm asking Julian to be ready pretty soon to sum up in a couple of minutes, and David after that. I'm also interested in whether there's anybody in the audience who feels really somewhat at odds with this discussion and the way that it's gone, and that their view has not been heard. But I'm not suggesting that's you.
Thank you. I just wanted to make a brief comment, really. I think undoubtedly that there are huge changes sweeping over society globally. This will be far too interesting. I fear that, as usual, the disadvantaged will suffer most. But my concern as an NHS worker is more with the nitty-gritty. It seems to me that large NHS institutions have a tendency to slip into a default mode that is actually very top-down, very controlling, very hierarchical. And I think the question might be, what do we need to do in order to promote an opening up of that kind of institution? Because the hierarchical model is never going to be an agent that promotes equality and addresses unmet need.
Julian, you've got a couple of minutes to close.
Right. Well, it's a very interesting discussion and very, on the whole, very positive. I am still worried about turning what I think is essentially a political problem, a problem of social organisation and resource allocation, you know, what priorities we have, mixing that kind of thing up with personal moral failure. Doctors, hospital cleaners, porters, nurses, social workers who fail and having failed just settle into failure and walk past these people who drop their spectacles. That is a very serious problem. But part of the problem is to see it as a moral problem. This is an institutional failure, and increasingly as we get marketized it will be a market failure. The market doesn't do those things well, unless, of course, it happens to have a box that you tick to get the money. Then it'll be done all right, which is what's happening in the garage. It's the industrialization of social care, including the care of children in the home, or, you know, wherever they are now. That's the enemy. I was a bit disappointed that there was so little discussion about the fundamental issue of consumerism and seismic shifts and all that jazz. I think what Phil said was absolutely right. The problem we've got is that it's no good waiting for capitalism to fail by itself, global capitalism to fail by itself. Of course it's failing, but it's a global failure. I mean, we only have one globe to live on. And it's like Hitler, it's pulling the roof down. You know, I go, then you all bloody go. I'm sorry, you're not. I think an answer to an awful lot of things would be, we've got to have conditions in which we can find the answers. I mean, believe me, democratizing care is not easy. I once had the idea, I had control over my population. I was a despot, as all GPs were, and many still are. I could do what I wanted, which is a very primitive and bad situation, but the best you can make of it is at least to try to do good things that demolish that absurd structure of a public service being in private ownership and control. You naturally think, well, you're going to have an elected patients committee. We had a meeting of the whole village, a meeting like this one, same sort of attendance. We had about 10 more. I estimate this is about 170. We had about 180. And representing about 500 families in the village. Well-attended meeting to elect a patient committee. It was quite clear within days of the event that we were just going to have the usual people that always elect themselves to committees in villages. Mostly good people, but they are the committee mongers. So I had to go around guiding democracy, finding the mothers of young children, the mothers I can't remember the politically correct phrase, but mentally handicapped, damaged, you know, brain damaged children, and people with real big problems that made them big users of the NHS, who are in a class by themselves as critics. They've got to be experienced enough not just to be angry, but to actually want to get things improved, and on the whole, operating through the people we have and where we actually are. They have to be quite mature people to do that. So I spotted a few, you know, sure enough, they were elected. A year later, I suggest, oh, let's have another meeting and have another election. Oh, well, why do you want to do that? Aren't we doing a good job? Well, yeah, we're doing a good job. Actually, some of them weren't, but I mean, you can't say that. But that's what democracy is. Oh, no, they didn't like that. Now, that committee is still in existence. There have been I've had two successors since then. They can't get rid of it. But it hasn't really been a very effective force, and it certainly doesn't correspond to what any of you are imagining would be participative democracy. So we haven't solved that. And my feeling in the end was that I should have got my diabetics together, I should have got my very fat people together, perhaps in the same group, because they're all going to be diabetics if they don't watch out, and all my hypertensives, or, you know, different user groups. They would have been a more potent force. But the key thing is that this is a committee or whatever it is to fight. You really have, this is a battle. It is a battle. And that's the thing I would like to end on, is that we really have to remember that. I wasn't looking forward to the end of the class war in 1945. I was looking forward to the beginning of it. I mean, really serious, you know, now let's win it. But I want the world to be run by people who work. I don't want anybody to be in the world living off what they own. I want them to be living from what they do. If they're not able to do anything, then that is in itself a problem, and they can teach us all about what it's like to be somebody who can't do anything. But I don't want anyone to live from what they own and control. And I want victory in that. And I'm not looking for some nice sort of permanent truce between the people who live from what they own and the people who live from what they do. It is nowadays, of course, very difficult. It always was difficult because people are divided. We've got lots of people who live both from what they own and from what they do. But they get their comeuppance. I mean, all these people who've been living in houses which were not mainly for the purpose of being lived in, but mainly for the purpose of making a whacking great profit, often, actually in recent months, rather greater than they earned at the end of the week from their wages. Now that was a lunacy, and you know, that's the kind of thing that's crashing now. But if we remember that if we are not involved in struggle, we're not really doing anything. It's got to be, you've got to be up against it, really. Thanks.
I guess we're into personal history and recollection. I'll make mine brief. I think I still, in a battered kind of way, think of myself as a socialist, but I have learned it's a more complicated thing trying to do that than I believed it was in 1945.
Definitely.
And one of the formative experiences in my life was spending 5 years chairing the Supplementary Benefits Commission. Most of you won't even know what it was, but we were responsible for the means-tested benefits that we now call income support, job seekers allowance, and other related benefits on which the poorest people in the land depended. And I used to go every year to the political conferences of the main parties and also to the TUC annual conference, heartland of the Labour movement, where I heard expert, thoughtful, humane discussion of workers' rights, of wages, of health and safety, of all the insurance benefits for employed workers contributing to the national insurance system. Never a mention of supplementary benefits or the means-tested benefits. Hardly ever a mention of child benefits. Tried over the bar once, talking with a group of miners at that conference. What do you think about child benefits then? Which is massively important because you retain it when you go back to work, and it enables you to pay more to people who are out of work without it producing disincentives to work, because they'll still have that when they go back into work. And I was told child benefits is paying for other men's pleasures. They were not exactly a bunch of feminists, though they were all voted for Scargill. Now, you know, the public service professions have their own tyrannies and their own exclusions, and they tend to exclude the people who aren't in a public service. Julian's given us a wee bit of that flavour. If you're not working for a living, you're not really a proper citizen. Well, there are a hell of a lot of us in this country, and people concerned with advocacy meet them every day, who are not able to work for a living.
I didn't say that.
And need the support and care of the rest of us, and we should be proud to offer that. Mm. So we should really be thinking, what can each of us do? I think I've learnt too, final point, that the people who say, you know, public service good, private sector bad, are about as helpful, creative and intelligent as the people in other kinds of meetings in other rooms who are saying private sector good, public sector and the government bad. These are not the main dimensions of the human race that determine justice and humanity. And you know, we've got to think harder than that. We've got to think about what each of us can do to put it right within whatever organisation we find ourselves working in.
We didn't expect to have a big bang or to find out huge new secrets or knowledge at this meeting, but we did hope to give voice to important concerns, and I hope you agree with me that that has been achieved. I'd like to thank the people who very promptly agreed to support this meeting. Both its travel costs, the drinks reception to which you're welcome to stay for the next wee while in the foyer, for the audiovisual support, because the session will be archived and made available through the Glasgow Centre for Population Health. We're going to have a meeting tomorrow to reflect on this meeting and revisit some of the arguments. And I hope that will be a written output in due course. All of that has required resource. So I'm particularly grateful to Sally McIntyre of the MRC Social and Public Health Research Unit, Alison Pollock from the University of Edinburgh, from John Frank, also from the University of Edinburgh, for the Scottish MRC Collaboration in Public Health Research and Policy, just arrived from Canada. Very welcome. And we're also supporting it from the Department of General Practice and Primary Care in the University, and not least the Glasgow Centre for Population Health has also chipped in. And it says something that we were able to achieve that so quickly. So I hope that you bear in mind who supported this meeting, all one of the organisations. None of you will be, have been corrupted by having a peanut or a glass of wine next week or so. My final wish is to that you'll thank David and Julian for coming, spending time with us. The issues are not really theirs, they're ours, and we need to find other ways of taking them forward. Thank you very much.